Welcome to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Doug Hagmann, Joe Hagmann, something I like to call America's premier father-son investigative reporting team, live on Global Star Radio Network. I want to thank Global Star for airing us, as well as the fine folks at Blog Talk Radio, that's BTR, and our two respective shows, mine 9 to 10 in the morning, Joe and John, of course, 2 to 3, and feedback appreciated, either show. Just simply send an email to studio at Hagmann and Hagmann.com. The previous hour, if you missed that, go back and listen to Kaya Jones, an incredible young lady, a member, the ex-Pussycat Doll, Pussycat Dolls. Forgive me if I've gotten that incorrect. That's not my music genre, but nonetheless. But what an engaging story, and what an uplifting, inspirational story that was. Now, speaking of inspirational, uplifting, and also informational, Peter Barry Chowka has contributed so much to the Hagmann Report, and he's done a lot of investigative reporting. If you go back and look at some of his early articles at American Thinker, if you just go to American Thinker and insert his name, and by the way, we've gotten so many emails from listeners who say, I've got a new favorite guest, Peter Barry Chowka. And,
a lot of people like,
oh my goodness. But he's written a lot about his early articles, a lot about the healthcare. And now, the news with the healthcare, Affordable Care Act, has kind of taken a back seat. But his articles of late at Hagmann Report have really outlined the detailed, the sole purpose, and I cannot echo this enough, that healthcare, it's not about the government helping you or making sure you're covered. Healthcare is not about healthcare. Newsflash. It's about control, whether it's the control of one-fifth or even greater of the U.S. economy, or control over behavior, lifestyle, and choices. It's Marxism, socialism, communism. That's what it's really all about. And Peter Barry Chowka has done an excellent job in laying it all out. Please go to HagmannReport.com. His latest is up at HagmannReport.com. But also, don't forget to go back into American Thinker and read some of the articles he had penned earlier, much earlier. And he's been on this for decades. In fact, he's been one of the first to call out, I believe, to call out single-payer healthcare for what it is, a mechanism of control. And he did so, and I echo that sentiment, and I don't think I can add much more than that. With that, welcome, Peter, to the program.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for that extensive and very nice introduction. And I do appreciate your calling the attention of the audience to all of the articles of mine, which are online and all available for free reading. There are more than 100 of them at American Thinker, the vast majority written since May of this year, and I believe about 55 articles that I've done for the Hagmann Report, which are also online and linked actually from the homepage of HagmannReport.com. So I would really encourage people who are interested in what we talk about to really check out the articles, because that's where I really am able to get into the detail. And there's probably about 150,000 words worth of material at American Thinker, and at least 100,000 words that I've written for the Hagmann Report. That's several books worth right there.
Absolutely.
That's all available for free reading.
And I know that I've got to tell the audience this, because I really appreciate how you write. You struggle over your articles. So when I say struggle, it's not a struggle over making it just right, I suppose, and conveying the message. So you do a fine job, a great job, as a matter of fact. And I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. So, yes, several books worth of articles, and I would urge everyone to really bone up on what you've written about. This is our treat this week. This is the second time this week that you've been on the show, and we're so grateful to have you. Now, single payer healthcare, should we start there?
Sure.
Okay. Let's do that. By the way, I'm glad you're joined by your feline friend there. We appreciate that. And that's a great painting too. I like that painting.
That's actually a photograph. I'm a photographer in addition to a writer, and that's a photo I took of one of the two cats.
Ah.
And he's actually appearing live, sitting on the sofa behind me.
Right.
Lured. There he is. Looks like he's looking at his portrait. But, you know, you can have these pictures made from a digital photo, and they look like a painting. But it's actually a photograph, and his name is Biggie.
Biggie?
He's about 4 years old, and Biggie, the camera is in this direction, Biggie. Biggie.
There we go. Wow, look at those eyes.
He's an amazing cat. He has a dog-like personality. He's very friendly, greets people who come to the house, and has no fear. And our other feline, whose name is Lulu, slightly older than Biggie and also a rescue cat, who is also solid gray, she's very shy, and she's asleep in another part of the room, but it would be hard to lure her in front of the camera. This is Biggie's premiere appearance today. There he goes. But I'm glad to see that he finally made it.
All right. Biggie making the debut on the Hagman Report. Fantastic. And of course,
by the way, the reason that I chose to put the photo of Biggie up, the large photo, is I've been told that several people commenting on the YouTube chat have asked, oh, where's the cat photo? Because earlier on, I had a photo of another of our cats, now deceased, Ekaterina, the Russian Blue.
Right.
Haven't had that photo up there lately, but I thought I'd go all out today with the large photo of Biggie and his first live appearance. So
I got to tell you, I was going to send you an email. I got one email, suspecting, and this is so funny. I thought originally it was in jest, but this person was serious, suspecting that the placement of the feline, the cat pictures, were some sort of a covert signal you were sending out to people. So.
To a secret cat cult out there.
There you go.
To the Russian.
To the Russians.
Actually, one of the cats we had once, we gave the name Bastet. She was an Abyssinian cat, and they had their origins in actually ancient Egypt. And there was a cult of Bast or Bastet in ancient Egypt, because the Egyptians thousands of years ago worshipped cats. And she still has a website, bastet.net, but it's funny because I'll get email sometime or page views to that for people looking for the cult of Bast. So people wow. do worship cats out there. So
yeah,
you find them indeed.
Well, now that you've really brought the level of excitement of Lady the Studio Dog to her, she's at full awareness now. Settle down, lady. Okay. Let's get into single payer healthcare, because you've written something that I believe is the definitive work to lay out look, single payer healthcare is communism. It's what it is. It's all about control, isn't it?
Right. Well, there were two articles I was able to put up at the Hagman Report, I think this week or in the very short period here. The first one was about single payer and socialized medicine. Actually, the second one is on the screen now, so maybe I'll start with that. The smoking gun, you know, proponents of government-run healthcare or Obamacare or the full bore one, single payer, which is full socialist communist state-run medicine, they say, well, this is the only option left to us. Everything else has failed. The free market has failed. The prices are too high. The costs are going up. And people remain uncovered by health insurance. And they're dying in the streets, in effect, which is, of course, all spin and incorrect. So they say that we have to go the single-payer route. But, of course, a single-payer, well, not only has it failed every place it's been tried in the Western world, but I returned in this recent article, which went online, I think, yesterday at the Hagman Report, to an expose I did some years back, actually in 2010. And it deserved to be resurrected in the light of now that we're closer than ever, apparently, to single payer. especially if the Democrats ever gain control again, and they probably will in our lifetimes. And this occurred on right the day after Obamacare was passed by the Congress. It was rammed through the Congress on a straight party line vote in March of 2010 after a lot of debate. And the Democrats had full control of Congress then, so they pushed it through based on a pack of lies, basically. So critical in that passage was the longest-serving member of Congress at that time, John Dingell Jr., who was in his 80s then. At that point, he had been a representative in Congress for 55 years. He finally retired 5 years later after 60 years, and he was inheriting the seat from his father, John Dingell Sr., who was in there for 22 years, starting in 1933, when FDR first became president. And now that Dingell Jr. has retired, his young wife has inherited the position. So incredibly, for the last 85 years, without interruption, a member of the Dingell family has represented that district of southeastern Michigan in the U.S. House of Representatives. So this character, John Dingell Jr., was given a lot of credit for helping the passage of Obamacare, because since day one, when he entered the Congress in 1955, he kept introducing legislation calling for government-run single-payer health care. And of course, this got nowhere in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, until Hillary Care was proposed under Bill and Hillary Clinton in 1993. And thank God that failed. But Barack Hussein Obama. So the day after Obamacare was passed, John Dingell Jr. appeared on a radio station by telephone. He was in Washington. The radio station was in Detroit. And he appeared for about 12 minutes live on a Detroit talk show. And if I had not been privy to reading about this in an obscure blog and tracking down the MP3 recording, the podcast of the show, it would have just sunk without a trace, because it's a small local program. He gave this interview and it would have been forgotten. Fortunately, I was able to find the MP3 and write an article for American Thinker, which appeared on March 24th, 2010. And in it, I simply quoted the essential part of what Dingell had to say. And I'm just going to, it's a brief quote. I want to call it up on my screen here so I get it exactly. Okay, John Dingell said, "Let me remind you, this has been going on for years." And by this, he meant Americans allegedly dying because of the lack of government-run universal health care, which is a lie. I won't take the time to go into that, but that's fake news. He went on, "We are bringing it to a halt. We are bringing that to a halt, people dying because they didn't have government-guaranteed health care through Obamacare." To continue, "The harsh fact of the matter is when you're going to pass legislation that will cover 300 American people," there he misspoke, and he later admitted that. He meant to say, of course, 300 million American people. But this guy's kind of out of it, so he said 300 American people. Anyway, "to pass legislation that will cover 300 million American people in different ways, it takes a long time to do the necessary administrative steps that have to be taken to put the legislation together to control the people." To control the people. So there it was, the smoking gun, as I have termed it. One of the top Democrat leaders of the United States Congress, who had been there almost forever, 55 years at that point, saying the purpose of Obamacare was to control the people, unquote. That was a direct quote, not edited, not chopped up or taken out of context. Well, fortunately, my article in American Thinker was picked up by a variety of some of the top conservative websites at the time, all of them with credit to me in American Thinker, including Hot Air, which was Michelle Malkin's site at the time, Gateway Pundit, Red State, the Heritage Foundation, the Washington Times, and Fox News. It was also picked up by Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly. The latter two did not give us credit, but that's okay. I'm not looking for credit. I'm just looking for the story, the news to get out. So Dingell's office, later that very day, March 24th, the same day my article and these other articles went online, his office issued a statement, which I was able to find courtesy of archive.org. And I quote that in my article. I won't take the time to read the whole thing, but it's just ridiculous spin in which he tries to claim that when he said control the people, he actually meant we are going to end the deplorable practices of those who rescind the health insurance policies of people on gurneys heading into emergency rooms. I mean, you've got to read this to appreciate the lying, fake spin that these Democrats are capable of and trying to put over on us, this complete nonsense, because he was caught with his pants down in making that statement that we're trying to control the people. And it reminded me of what Jonathan Gruber, the MIT economist who was one of the chief architects of Obamacare, said in a speech in 2014, I believe it was, and this was recorded and later put on YouTube, and he was caught with his pants down, so to speak, in which he said, to paraphrase, I quote this in my article, but to paraphrase, he said something like, we Democrats had to rely on the stupidity of the American voter in order to get Obamacare passed. Yep. So you look at the statements of these characters who were basically the leaders of the Democrat Party in getting this legislation going, and I mean, they expose themselves. They do our work for us if we can only find, ferret out what they've actually said and quote them accurately. So that's what single payer is all about. And of course, now we have virtually every leading Democrat who wants to run for president against Donald Trump in 2020. Every leading Democrat is signing on to the Democrat single payer plan that's been introduced by a socialist communist Bernie Sanders. And this would actually end Obamacare, but it would make it even worse. It would mandate that everyone be part of a government-run health care plan. At the current time, as bad as Obamacare is, you can actually still opt out of it if you want to pay the penalty, the individual mandate, so-called the tax to the IRS, if you can't prove that you have Obamacare-endorsed overpriced insurance for conventional medicine coverage for the previous tax year, but you can still opt out of it. But if single payer goes through, there won't be that option anymore. You're going to be stuck yep. cradle to grave. So,
two questions, Peter, while I'm thinking of this. The Hillary Care back in 92, you've got I believe you got an eidetic memory, but the Hillary Care, did that start off with was that a single payer only proposal back in 90, whenever it was in the 90s?
It actually was introduced in 1993. Bill Clinton ran on that platform in 92. He was elected, took office in 93, and immediately after taking office, he appointed his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, as the head of the Health Care Reform Task Force. And it fell to her to have a number of secret meetings, no transparency, to concoct Hillary Care, which was another 1,000-plus page abomination. And although they didn't call it single payer, it was basically that. All Americans would have to have been part of it. Everyone would have received a government health care card with a special number on it, and you would be cradle to grave covered. And what it also did was to criminalize any pay as you go concierge medicine. In other words, you wouldn't be able to go to a doctor or a healer or a clinician, pay that person cash for health care. Everybody would have to, every health provider would essentially have to be working for the government, reimbursed by the government, and they could not get around that. So this was total Soviet-style medicine. But even if they pass single payer now, you know, it's got a new name now. It sounds, you know, less harmful or less dangerous, single payer, you know, groovy. It will evolve into the same thing where they'll have us between a rock and a hard place, and it will evolve into a draconian, no opt-out method. But Hillary Care was absolutely horrendous, and it's interesting that in the 25 years that have passed since then, things have changed so much that, Hillary Care never even got to a vote. It was so unpopular, even among the Democrats who controlled Congress at that point, that it was not brought up for a vote. And not only that, but in the next congressional election in 1994, for the first time in decades, the Republicans won both houses of Congress because supposedly because the American voters were so disgruntled and fed up with the Clintons, particularly because of the proposal of Hillary Care. So at that point, socialized medicine, government-run medicine, was still very, very unpopular, as it had been since the days of the founding fathers. Well, in the last two decades or so, the shadow government, the deep state, the globalists, the New World Order, and the medical industrial complex and big pharma, all of them working together hand in glove. Oh, and we don't want to forget the media, too, because they've worked their magic at even remaking Obamacare. Obamacare, when it was passed into law in 2010 and then went fully into effect about 4 years later, was always unpopular. All of the polls taken found that a majority of Americans from 2010 until recently didn't like Obamacare. They didn't approve of it by a roughly 2-to-1 margins. It's only been in the last year or so since President Trump took office and since the rise of his Make America Great Again theme that the media and the powers that be have really doubled down and gone to work with their propaganda, so that now the average American voter, apparently low-information voter, thinks that single-payer socialized medicine dusted off with a new, more palatable name, single-payer, is the way to go. Well, and why wouldn't they think that? Because Obamacare has made the situation worse, and Obama himself promised it would get better. Each family would save $2,000. We'd be able to keep our doctor, keep our health plan. All of them outrageous lies. In fact, chosen as the PolitiFact lie of the year in 23, the collection of Obama's lies about Obamacare. So, of course, Obamacare has raised premiums. A lot of people have had to pay the penalty instead of getting health care. It's a mess, and a choice is being limited. But why anybody would think that choice will be expanded and that the government bureaucracy getting involved would help the situation, it's just not going to happen. But once again, we have to look at the news media, with the only conduit of information for most people being the mainstream news media, and they're getting one side of the story. We see how, this is a classic textbook example, how when the echo chamber of the conventional mainstream news media goes to work on an issue, as they have done on Obamacare and on single payer, they can sell it to the American people. It's outrageous, but that is what's happening, and it's a really amazing example happening in real time.
Any chance of an outright appeal or repeal? As simple as that question is, I'm just curious. Any chance whatsoever of just a no replace, just repeal and be done with it?
Not unless the only hope there, and it may be a distant hope, but if somehow the Republicans, conservative-oriented Republicans, Donald Trump supporters, could increase their majority in Congress next year in the congressional elections, there would be hope. Because right now the Republicans control Congress, but so many of them, like Susan Collins or John McCain, are rhinos who, when the chips are down, they were afraid to or unwilling to vote for repeal and replace Obamacare when that vote came up several months ago. So it doesn't look like it's going to happen with this Congress. What we still can hope will happen is that under the current debate that's going on in Congress on the new tax proposals, the tax cuts, I believe that the drafts of that have the repeal of the individual mandate. And that will certainly help because that, in my mind, is one of the worst elements of Obamacare. I mean, if you think about it, it's the first time in the history of the United States that the government, in effect, has been able to put a gun to your head and say, you have to buy this product or service, conventional, government-approved, expensive, overpriced medical health care for conventional medicine. It doesn't cover natural medicine or alternative medicine, the kinds of things millions of us are interested in. It covers only allopathic conventional medicine. And it's being enforced by the Internal Revenue Service. If you don't pay that fine, if you can't prove that you've had that that approved insurance in the previous 12 months, you have to pay a fine based on a percentage of your income. And there's a minimum. Even if you have no income, if you don't have to file a tax return, you still have to pay a basic fine to the IRS. And the Supreme Court considered that, as you know, and Chief Justice Rogers, right, voted against it, you know, for whatever reason. Roberts. But at least if that can be repealed, you know, it will be something. And, you know, to focus for a moment on alternative medicine, as it was called. Now it's called complementary medicine or natural healing.
Good segue, by the way. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're interested in this. Every other Friday you have Ted Brewer on to talk about that in depth. And, you know, studies, actually government studies, find that about 40% of the adult American population right now, as we speak, 40% of us use some form of so-called alternative, unconventional medicine, a prayer for healing, herbal supplements, nutritional supplements, chiropractic, naturopathic medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, traditional Chinese medicine. There's quite a list of things that fall under the heading of alternative medicine. None of them is really approved by the federal government. And as a footnote there, I was involved 25 years ago, appointed as one of the first 100 advisors to the new National Institutes of Health's Office of Alternative Medicine, as it was called. And I devoted about 2 years of my time, part-time, to consulting with the NIH, going back and forth to Washington, D.C., to engage in meetings with my colleagues, the other panelists. And basically, it was a big waste of time. It went nowhere. And that whole office in the NIH of alternative medicine, which has since expanded to an exponential degree, I think they've spent about $1 billion since 1992 when it was started. And basically they've done nothing except to seduce and co-opt the new generation, or many of the new generation of alternative medicine proponents and practitioners, to kind of turn them into little bureaucrats who are chasing the money that the federal government will hand out for piddling research projects or kind of lightweight approval of what they're doing. This has certainly been the case with the conventional licensed naturopathic doctors in the United States. They have bought the government co-optation hook, line, and sinker, and have completely sold out their 100-year tradition of being natural healers. And now their agenda is to show how this works, and it's interesting to cite briefly this example. When the government gets involved in a field, they will kill you with kindness. They'll say, oh, we'll offer you approval and maybe even some money if you will kowtow to our definition and our rules of what you're doing. And I find to my shock and dismay that there were many, if not a majority, of people in alternative medicine, many of the self-styled leaders at that point in the early 1990s, who were more than willing to enter into that Faustian bargain. And they have completely transformed their professions of natural healing into like conventional medicine light. And the name they've given this now, which the government came up with, was complementary medicine. Now, if you just think about that, because language is very important, if you have an alternative medicine approach, but it's now being called complementary, well, what does that mean? That means that the alternative is seen as a complement or an ancillary adjunctive therapy to the number one therapy, which is conventional allopathic drug-oriented medicine, right? So the alternative, at best or at most, will just be a small adjunct to business as usual with conventional healing. You know, in cancer, that means surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So the example I like to use is the alternative practitioners who used to say they were doing alternative cancer therapy, true alternatives, primary alternatives, are now happy and satisfied to maybe give their patients an herb, an herbal supplement, so that if they're getting chemotherapy, which is making them nauseous, or radiation, which is making them sick, well, just take this herbal supplement and it might help your nausea. That's now how they are now construing alternative medicine under the name of complementary medicine. It's sick and it's evil and it's completely destroyed natural healing in this country. I mean, books could be written on that. And unfortunately, I know where the bodies are buried, no pun intended. But, you know, literally, that's another example.
Yeah.
That's another example. Sometimes in these anecdotal examples, we can learn a lot.
Absolutely. And you are a great teacher, by the way, in your research, in your writings, and of course, in appearances like this.
You talk about the holistic and natural cures and what the medical association, how they have been able to really, push those down to where people who look for alternative forms of healing and medicine, can't say things cure you, can't say things help you. Even kratom, a substance that is used for a number of things, from pain relief to helping from withdrawal symptoms to focus, anxiety, that is,
it's all being demonized.
I mean, a lot of people, swear up and down by it, say it helps them so much they didn't have to take, prescription pain pills. Instead, they were able to take this. And the feds see this as a way around modern medicine and the medical establishment. So what do they want to do? They want to ban it and or, make it a controlled substance. And that's just one example of a laundry list of things we could go on and on about, from the essential oils to so many other things that are demonized and attempted to be controlled by the medical community. And this is all leading, Peter, to what you have laid out in your article and have been talking about for a long time. This single payer, state owned, healthcare is just a trap for total control of the healthcare, just as you pointed out. And if we don't have defenders of this, to keep things going back to the way they were with private insurance and private healthcare, then we're going to be in a lot of trouble. And I fear we're only one real Democratic administration away from seeing the single payer healthcare model rolled out as law.
Absolutely. Joe, that's an excellent series of points you just made. And we have to keep in mind that the kinds of healthcare alternatives that at least 40% of Americans are now using, that is natural therapies, both preventative and therapeutic, came about because of the relative free market in medicine, which defined United States healthcare until the last decade or two. It was competition and the relative free market that gave rise to this kind of libertarian free market impulse, which allowed things like many of the things you just mentioned and others to come to the fore, and people would find out about them, start using them, see that they worked. And, oh, by the way, isn't it interesting that almost all of these alternative natural approaches are extremely inexpensive when you compare them to conventional medicine? Conventional medicine is so overpriced now, the mind can't even take it all in. It's medicine in this country is now the biggest collection of businesses. It's costing us over $3.5 trillion with a T dollars a year, and that's about five times bigger than the military industrial complex. That's how big it is. And it's based on selling us treatments that you just said, Joe. The federal government historically and to this day has been interested in trying to regulate natural, safe therapeutic options, many herbal or nutritional supplements. They'll say, oh, that's not tested enough, or you can't make these claims about it, even if it's been in use for 100 years or more, you know, you just can't go there. Meanwhile, these drugs, these toxic pharmaceutical drugs are approved, and how many of them eventually are shown to be that they don't work, or that they're actually dangerous to the extent that they're killing people and they have to be recalled. And then you see all the advertisements on cable television with ambulance chasing lawyers saying, did you take this drug? Did you take that drug? If so, call this 800 number because there may be money in it for you if you can show that you've been harmed. I mean, this is just beyond belief. But, you know, I had the benefit to be able to spend much of my journalistic career looking into alternative medicine. And that came about because when I got involved in writing about healthcare in the 1970s, and I go into this a little bit in an article I wrote a few weeks ago for the Hagman Report. Oh, and by the way, at my latest article today for the Hagman Report, at the end of it, I list and link to the 5 other articles that I've written for the Hagman Report on healthcare in recent months, and also one at American Thinker, so people can easily find and click on those, because it really amounts to almost at least a small ebook in all of the content and all of the words. And the series will be continuing, but in one of the articles I pointed out how I got involved in this, and specifically 40 years ago as we speak, I was researching an article about the National Cancer Institute in Washington, D.C. And 5 years before that, the United States had started an official war on cancer. Overnight, they designated cancer worthy of the first war that wasn't a military war in our history, and they poured billions of dollars into the National Cancer Institute and the war on cancer overnight. And of course, it became a bureaucratic boondoggle, and 46 years later now, we're really no closer to finding a cure for cancer than we were when that cancer war was signed by Richard Nixon in 1971. And it was a bipartisan effort, by the way. Excuse me. So what happened was in the mid-1970s, when the cancer cure did not occur as promised in time for the bicentennial, some in the mainstream media and me and a few others started looking into this. And I found at the National Cancer Institute, through an esteemed founder of the NCI, Dr. Dean Burke, who showed me scientific studies from the early part of the 20th century. And I told him I was interested in the area of diet cancer, which was kind of getting a new interest in the 1970s. And he said, Peter, there's nothing new under the sun. This was a vigorous area of scientific inquiry in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s. And he showed me scientific studies from that period, books on diet and cancer from the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, which were finding out things like there is such a thing as an anti-cancer diet, that you are what you eat, that certain nutritional factors can be used therapeutically if you get cancer. Well, what happened? I said, well, what happened was chemotherapy drugs came along coming out of World War II, and studies of poison gas experiments. It was found that nitrogen mustard caused a syndrome in the people who were exposed to it, which might, having to do with blood levels, which might actually have some relevance to the treatment of leukemia, which is a blood disorder. And as bizarre as that sounds, chemotherapy was born treating people with leukemia, and it grew from there. It was incredibly profitable, and it pushed every other alternative, including diet and cancer, into the background. So flash forward to 1977, when I was doing my first reporting on this, and 30, 40, 50 years had gone by that point, when diet and cancer had been pushed into the background. And by bringing it up to the present, I was inspired to think of this again, because there were 2 reports in recent months where, again, the federal government this time admitted that new studies have found that lifestyle factors, particular diet and cancer, are now unquestionably associated with both the occurrence of cancer, the incidence of cancer in the United States, and how well people survive it when they get cancer. So when you look back, about 100 years of scientific effort have been lost because, due to the government's tremendous influence in the whole field of medicine, they have put the kibosh on progressive innovative, meaningful research into diet and cancer. You know, they pretty much called it criminal between the 1940s and recently. I mean, if you were trying to research diet and cancer, you were shown the door in the research establishments and the universities, and you couldn't get any research grants. I mean, a man like Dr. Linus Pauling, who I knew quite well, I interviewed him over a dozen times, only person in history to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. He died in 1994 at age 93. He proposed that vitamin C was a preventative and a treatment for human cancer. Now, here's a man who was accorded the honor of being regarded as one of the 20 best scientists in the history of Western medicine. And the minute he got interested in the field of diet, vitamins, and cancer, he was called a quack by the establishment. He couldn't get any official research funding. He had never been questioned before in his career. He was considered a genius. He wrote the definitive text on the nature of the chemical bond. The minute he got involved with nutritional research and orthomolecular medicine, which is a field that he gave the name to, he was persona non grata, and he had to swim upstream for the rest of his career. And he used to delight in telling me that one reason he liked vitamin C so much is that for a cost of about $12 per kilogram or 1,000 grams of vitamin C, it could be an effective treatment for cancer compared with hundreds of thousands of dollars that a person with cancer might spend on conventional treatment with not very successful outcomes. So there again we have an example that I can cite, one that I got deeply into and which I wrote about in one of the articles I did for the Hagman Report, is the last interview with Linus Pauling, which I had the privilege of conducting 3 or 4 months before he passed away in 1994. And the transcript of it is at the Hagman Report. And that's worth reading because he is one of the giants, not only of Western science and medicine, but of world science, widely acknowledged. But his work on health, medicine, and nutritional medicine is largely overlooked or forgotten today. And by the way, the federal government, when I was collaborating or consulting with the United States government in the late 1980s through the mid-90s there in Washington, D.C., they took steps through the old Office of Technology Assessment at the U.S. Congress, which was conducting a 5-year study of alternative or unconventional cancer treatments. They took sinister steps to blacklist Dr. Pauling's research by hiring a hack researcher who had no qualifications. He was a medical doctor, but he was unqualified to write about nutritional medicine, particularly medicine proposed by a man at the Nobel Prize level. So this hack writer wrote a demeaning, distorted research paper about vitamin C and Dr. Pauling, and the Office of Technology Assessment, which was preparing this major study for the U.S. Congress, didn't even let Dr. Pauling know about this research paper. I had to get my hands on a copy of it because I was working with the Office of Technology Assessment as an unpaid advisor at that point. And I photocopied it and got it to Dr. Pauling so he could try to make a response. But then the Office of Technology Assessment just ignored his response. And that study, by the way, is still in print. You can find it online. The Office of Technology Assessment 1990 study called Unconventional Cancer Treatments. And, it's another basic blacklist of alternative cancer therapies. So
it seems to me, and correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that we do have a cure for cancer. And I know how simplified that sounds, but really a combination between a preventative measures as well as a cure, combine them both, we can beat cancer, but it's not being, or is that a true statement, or is that overstating?
No, here's, as you can imagine, Doug, since I've been writing about In addition to everything else I've written about, politics, media, popular culture, I've written a lot about healthcare and healthcare bureaucracy, socialized medicine, and alternative medicine for over four decades. Very close on to probably thousands of articles if I added them all up. And as you can imagine, I've gotten that question a lot. And here's what I've always said, and I continue to say it. I would say that there are approaches out there today, many of them underground, many of them being quietly offered, many of them being offered by qualified, credentialed, esteemed medical doctors, licensed medical doctors who are doing this work kind of on the QT. You know, they can't really run it up the flagpole or else. And they are achieving results using primary natural therapeutics, a variety of them. They are achieving results that are as good or better than what conventional medicine is getting. You know, it's difficult when you say there are cures out there, because that suggests that there is a substance or treatment or something that will cure cancer. And of course, every case of cancer, every individual person who gets cancer is first and foremost an individual with an individual case of that disease in terms of what caused it, what that person's commitment to treating it is. You know, there are emotional, psychological, and spiritual dimensions that come into play here, some of which have now been actually quantified in basic scientific research, and that's really interesting. But you know, every person is a unique case. So what might work for one person? I mean, I've actually run across a few cases where conventional chemotherapy has worked for a person with cancer. In my opinion, there aren't a lot of them, but there are some. And yet it wouldn't work for another person, maybe with that same kind of cancer. And you find the same thing with so-called alternative therapies, that, you know, therapy A might work for one patient with, say, breast cancer, a similar stage, but that same therapy will not work for another woman with the same cancer at a similar stage. So, you know, it's hard to say, yeah, there's an alternative cure out there, or there's a conventional cure, but there are certainly approaches that I've documented and that have been documented in the literature, in some cases the foreign literature, that have shown to be effective and, I would add, worth further serious, objective, and fair study. And that's what they never get. The federal government, to my knowledge, has never in the history of the United States, given any of the hundreds of billions of dollars that they have given to cancer research, they've never given any to a fair and objective study of an unconventional, alternative, or natural primary therapy for cancer. They said they tried to in 1999, 2000, with my late friend, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, who died 2.5 years ago. The government actually approved a $1.4 million grant from the NIH and the National Cancer Institute for him and his colleague, Dr. Linda Isaacs, to do a study on their nutritional therapy against late-stage cancer. But what the government did there, and by the way, Nick Gonzalez, before he died, wrote an entire book about this called What Went Wrong. What the government did there is they designed that therapy, or they conducted it, so that it would eventually fail. And then they published a study in the scientific literature at the end of it saying, oh, it failed, it didn't work, it made the patients worse. And Dr. Gonzalez wasn't even given the benefit of reviewing that study before it was published, even though it was on his therapy. So I've seen that again and again with vitamin C, with Laetril, with the Hoxie therapy, with the Brzezinski therapy. I could name dozens to brainstorm it. They'll sometimes give a little bit of money. Oh, we're interested in studying this, or public pressure has led us to, you know, conduct a study of this or that therapy. and the people they hire to do the study or the institution they have do the study has already gone on record in many cases as poo-pooing the approach or having a built-in bias, or they design the study so that it doesn't follow the protocols of the proponent. Like vitamin C, for example, the federal government supposedly paid to study that in the early 1990s, and they hired a well-known opponent of alternative medicine, the late Dr. Charles Mertel of the Mayo Clinic, to conduct that study. And he did not follow the protocols as suggested by the late Dr. Linus Pauling, the two-time Nobel Prize winner. So if you don't follow the protocols of the proponent, then of course the study is not going to work because you're not following the method that the successful proponent used. So, you know,
sure, that
these are
makes
the
sense.
Games they play. It's a, you know, it's a kangaroo court. It's a joke, really. It's a joke. And today, unfortunately, the mainstream media used to be, to some extent, when I started in this, willing to look at these issues. But one thing that the government has succeeded in by playing nice with alternative medicine and starting up these bogus office of alternative medicine, etc., is, they bought themselves some cover. And the whenever the establishment media, if they ever looked into it now, the government has simply to say, oh, we're spending $100-200 million a year to study unconventional or complementary medicine. Don't look at us. You know, we're being fair and objective. So, again, they kill you with kindness. They co-opt and they seduce. And the next thing you know, the primary alternative is hard to find. I would argue that primary alternative medicine options are harder to find today when more people are interested than ever than they were 40 years ago when I was first starting.
And that's by design.
That's area.
Yeah.
It's by design.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Peter, I'll tell you something. We could listen to you all day and all night long. We got about 6 minutes left before the end of our program. I don't want to miss anything. So continue wherever, whatever topic, the floor is yours.
Well, maybe I'll just take a few minutes to, because like you guys, and you did an excellent job in the first hour, by the way, in covering today's breaking news. But of course, this morning and last night, with the two blockbuster stories that hit, the trial of the killer of Kate Steinle, getting off, totally off, which was, I think that news made me more angry than I have been in a long time. And what I would simply like to add there is an anecdotal account. And it's only that, but 25 years ago, I returned to the town I grew up in southern New England, not far from New York City. It's in the metro New York City area, for my first visit in 5 years to visit my now late mother. And it's a town I grew up in. I hadn't been there for 5 years. And as I made the rounds during my two-week visit, this, by the way, is in Fairfield County, Connecticut, which is a very high socioeconomic area, although my parents were lower middle-class origin, but they had the advantage of settling in a kind of ritzy town. They got in on the ground floor there and 1951, and I had the benefit of the good schools and all. But, when I would make the rounds, go to the supermarket, the Kmart, the Caldors, whatever, I would find to my amazement that I was hearing Spanish spoken more often by the customers and the staff than English. So I said to my mom, what's going on here? Well, have we been invaded? So this is just the flood of new immigrants who are here. And, of course, most of them were illegals. Now, this was starting 25 years ago in an area that was thousands of miles away from the border. And now that kind of invasion has spread to the four corners of the United States. And as in another example, the state of California has been, as the Latino residents like to say, it's been reconquered. Reconquista, the La Raza or the race movement, has succeeded in reconquering California to return it to its Mexican origins. And we see the Democrat leader of the state legislature in California, the Democrat Party leader, recently bragged that more than half of his relatives living in California are here illegally. This is now a badge of honor if you live in California. So the Kate Steinle outrage, that young woman's death at the hands of this dirtbag who should have never been here and who is now free of any legal cost for having killed her. He admitted that he killed her, but he was exonerated for murdering her or even for manslaughter. It's you can't even wrap your mind around this, right? But it's happened. So I think of my memory in this in both California and both southern New England, and I say this is what we're dealing with now. The demographics is our destiny, and in my opinion, that's what's happened to Kate Steinle.
That's a great soundbite. Our demographics are our destiny. You can't say that any clearer, any better than that. Wow. Okay.
And just briefly on the Flynn case, just to wrap that up briefly. I've been trying to follow up on that today. And, of course, the initial media reports on his pleading guilty was, we're much closer now to nailing Donald Trump. And you and I and some others have been reporting for weeks, if not months, on how the target of the shadow government, the deep state of the mainstream media, is President Trump. So they are going to spin the Flynn a guilty plea to that end. But already some really good commentary is emerging. Just right before we went on the air, I read Andrew McCarthy's excellent piece, among others, in National Review today. He's a very esteemed lawyer. And let's see what we've got before we run off thinking that this is the end of President Trump. And I found some other articles linked from Real Clear Politics, which I would recommend again as a pretty good source for tapping into largely mainstream journalism, but from both sides of the fence. Really, they do a pretty good job of putting out a fair and balanced commentary and reporting from both sides. So it's actually good to get a look at what the other side is saying, and they look for some of the best reporting in that. So,
yes, sir.
You know, I think we'll see where that goes, but, you know, we just have to stand firm here and keep doing our jobs and trying to find where the truth lies. And I don't think, I sense, I hope, and I really don't believe it's going to spell the end of the Trump presidency anytime soon.
Boy, I hope and pray that you are correct. I believe that as well. I just worry about what the other side, the anti-Sean Hannity crowd, the anti-conservatives out there, the progressives, how they spin this and convince the American public otherwise. It's just a sickness in my view. You got about 15 seconds. What are you working on now?
I can't even remember. I've got so many irons in the fire. And I invite the audience, please go to my Twitter, twitter.com/pchowka.
Indeed.
P-C-H-O-W-K-A. I'd love to see you there.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, please, folks, if you have a Twitter account, follow pchowka on Twitter. Please do that.
Watch
do it tonight.
Watch the skies and watch the Hagman Report for my next contributions. There'll be many coming soon.
Peter, we love you. We respect you. We appreciate you. Thank you so very much for your gift of time tonight. And tell Biggie to get back in the picture.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Jay. Have a great weekend. God bless.
God bless you. Thanks, Peter. Thank you, brother.